The biggest electric car company on Earth is building a new factory in Europe. Working conditions are allegedly bad.
During the summer months, they could be working 12 to 14 hours a day.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. An exclusive look today at BYD labor practices. Also, U.S. officials say they're obliterating Iran on the battlefield.
But they watched in Iraq how they could fight the United States indirectly.
Like shutting the Strait of Hormuz.
And in the West Bank, rising settler extremism makes life risky for Palestinians.
In a very small confrontation, your life will be the cost.
Plus, how to get your Passover guests to appreciate gefilte fish.
I just force it on them.
If it's homemade, that's a different story.
Today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for joining us today. A Russian oil tanker arrived in Cuba over the weekend bringing much-needed fuel. It is the first shipment in months since the U.S. restricted oil deliveries to the island. Now President Trump says he will allow Russia and other countries to send fuel again, easing some pressure.
Mexico's president also said she plans to resume oil shipments. Cuba's energy crisis is so bad, though, that it's already caused long power outages across the country. The World's Tibi Saizeya has been looking into how Cubans are coping.
Cuban journalist Abraham Jimenez left Cuba 4 years ago, but his family is still in Havana. And a few weeks ago, he called his father on his birthday. It was midday, but I couldn't see his face, he says, because the house was dark and the power was out. He asked his dad to step outside so he could see him. And when he did, he turned the camera to the street, he says, and I saw a snapshot of my neighborhood.
Estaban haciendo una fogata para cocinar en el medio de la acera, rompiendo, no sé, un sillón, una mesa de madera.
People were cooking over open fires on the sidewalk, breaking up wooden chairs and tables to use as firewood.
Era entre semana y hay niños jugando porque no habían ido a la escuela.
It was a weekday, but kids were not in school, and people were just standing around because without transportation, you can't go anywhere. And my dad looked skinnier. He looked very sad. It was very hard to see, Jimenez says. That was the moment he understood the impact of this crisis. Cuba's energy problems have been building for years. Since 2024, the country has endured at least 5 total power collapses, mostly because of poor investment in the electrical grid and reduced oil shipments from Venezuela. But things have gotten worse in recent months since the U.S. blocked oil shipments. In Havana, my colleague Aileen Sosin spoke with people about how they are surviving. Most ask not to be named for fear of retribution.
Pero me afectan que cuando me tumban la electricidad es como si me apagaran a mí.
An engineer in Havana says when they cut the electricity, it's like they switch me off too.
Imagínate, yo he tenido noches que a las 3 de la mañana han puesto la luz y me he puesto a lavar esa hora.
I've had nights where the power comes back at 3 in the morning and I start washing clothes then, turn on my computer and jump to work. She says she once believed deeply in the socialist system. Now, after 30 years of working and investing her life in her country, she feels frustrated. It never improved. It got worse. It didn't work, she says. Some Cubans say responsibility goes beyond their government.
También está la parte del gobierno americano, ya. El bloqueo de Estados Unidos, eso sí afecta, sí afecta.
A doctor in Santiago de Cuba says the U.S. government is also to blame. He left his job at a hospital because his monthly salary was only enough to buy a few dozen eggs. He says the decades-long U.S. embargo has prevented hospitals from importing critical supplies.
Si tú afectas económicamente al gobierno de un país, donde ese gobierno es el que maneja prácticamente casi todo en este país, o sea, maneja la salud.
If you affect the government's finances, that affects everything: healthcare, electricity, transportation, and in the end, it affects the people.
Personas buscando comida en la basura. Eso yo nunca lo había visto. Eso sí ha sido lo más impactante.
Seeing people look for food in the trash, that's what shocked me the most, the doctor says. In recent weeks, a humanitarian flotilla organized by left-wing activists and politicians in Europe brought aid to Cuba, including food, medicine, and solar panels. But many Cubans were skeptical. For me, it's political tourism, says the engineer in Havana. Journalist Abraham Jimenez shares that frustration.
Porque ellos pueden entrar y yo no les voy a llevar un blister de aspirina a mi padre que hace dos.
Why can they enter Cuba and I can't even bring a pack of aspirin to my father who had a stroke 2 years ago? Jimenez was forced to leave Cuba after covering protests in 2021. In Santiago de Cuba, the doctor says what many people want is just a chance to choose their future.
Sí, me gustaría ver, tan siquiera probarlo, que sea el individuo quien decida.
I would at least like to try something different, he says, to have options, left, right, and let people decide. But he says that choice feels out of reach. Jimenez, the journalist, says Cubans are often caught between powers they can't control.
Siento todo el rato que la gente nos trata como a los cubanos como si fuéramos ratas de laboratorio, ¿no? Que la gente deposita en nosotros la manera de reforzar sus propias ideas.
People treat Cubans like lab rats, like a way to prove their own ideas on the left, on the right, inside and outside the island.
Y lo que queda de fondo es un país en ruina, ¿no? En ruina.
And in the end, what's left is a country in ruins, he says. Still, some people see this moment as a possible turning point.
Hay tristeza, pero hay esperanza también de que esto lo tomen allá y cambie. Yo también pienso lo mismo. ¿Qué tipo de cambio te quisiera ver?
There is sadness, but there is hope, too, that the U.S. could force change, says a young woman in Havana. President Trump has said he would have the, quote, honor of taking Cuba, language that Abraham Jimenez finds unsettling.
Por supuesto quiero que se caiga el régimen, pero yo no quiero que Cuba sea un protectorado.
Of course I want the regime to fall, he says, but I don't want Cuba to become a protectorate, especially not under Trump. But at the same time, he says,
yo entiendo que la gente que no tenga un plato de comida hoy, que no pueda tomar agua, le importe un bledo. Si
for the people who don't have anything to eat, it doesn't matter if it's Trump or the Dalai Lama who changes that situation. For the world, I'm Tivisa Isea, Mexico City.
Moving now to the war in Iran. In a press briefing this morning, U.S. Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth said that the next few days of the Iran war would be, as he says, decisive.
Iran knows that, and there's almost nothing they can militarily do about it.
This as more than 2,000 U.S. Marines arrived in the Gulf. The U.S. denies claims that this suggests the start of a ground invasion. The Speaker of Iran's parliament says that if U.S. troops do enter Iran, the country will rain fire on them. The Pentagon has repeatedly called such threats fantastical, claiming Iran's military capabilities have been destroyed. To get a sense of where the truth lies here, we turn to Sina Azodi, Director of Middle East Studies at George Washington University. He joins us from Washington. Sina, I want to start with a kind of baseline question here. So let's go back to before this war. Give me a sense of what Iran's military capabilities were like in terms of, let's say, the size and ability of the armed forces and stockpiles of weapons.
Iran has two major branches of armed forces. One is Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, which was created in the beginning of the revolution to check the power of the conventional army or the Artesh. It has its own ground forces, navy, and its aerospace force. But you also have the conventional army or Artesh, which is the professionally trained force. And all of these combined together, Iran can man 1 million army, including the reserves.
That sounds large to me. How does that compare to other countries' militaries?
So it's the largest in terms of quantity in the Middle East. But in terms of the quality of the equipment, Iranian military has largely been unable to modernize itself, basically focus on self-sufficiency. It doesn't have access to international arms market. And this is why you're seeing that Iran has a very robust missile program.
Because Iran can make those missiles and the launchers needed to launch them themselves?
Yes, it's an indigenous capacity that Iran has, but it was mostly as a result of the international arms embargo on the country, which hindered the country's attempts to buy modernized fighter aircrafts, tanks, etc., etc.
So now, a month into this war, attacks from the U.S. and Israel have been relentless. What is your assessment of Secretary Hegseth's statement this morning that, quote, there's almost nothing they can militarily do against the U.S. at this point, speaking of Iran?
Well, it's just, you know, factually and empirically incorrect to make that argument. Yes, the U.S. has been able to degrade Iran's capacity, but based on the information, the public information that is out there, the U.S. can only confirm the destruction of only one-third of Iran's missile program. And that two-third is launching and has been able to create a lot of chaos in the region. They hit the U.S. airbase in Saudi Arabia, which destroyed an American AWACS early warning system. And it is the first time in the history of modern warfare that a state has been able to destroy one of those very expensive planes that come at the cost of $700 million apiece.
The missile strikes have gone down significantly. I think last week, the commander of CENTCOM was saying that the rate of launching missiles decreased by 90%. Hegseth today said that the last 24 hours saw the lowest number of enemy missiles and drones fired by Iran. What can that tell us, and what can it not tell us about Iran's capabilities?
Well, there are many explanations for this. First of all, the U.S. operations to degrade Iran's missile capacity and drone capacity have had their impact.
And you're saying that we can confirm that about a third of the missile capability has been destroyed.
Right. And the second reason is that Iranians might be preparing for a longer conflict, which means that they are trying to preserve their assets as much as they can. And thirdly, then while the numbers have decreased, the degree of their success has, in fact, increased. So Iranians are launching less missiles, but with more accuracy and more rate of success.
The U.S. and Israel have boasted about striking Iranian military and political leaders, as well as air and naval assets. We have not heard much about the country's ground forces.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me about those capabilities?
If President Trump decides that he wants to, let's say, occupy parts of Iran or the islands, etc., we might see Iranian ground forces getting involved. And I think this is where Iran might have the advantage because they're fighting on their own soil and with larger numbers compared to the American side.
When we talk about the potential of U.S. ground troops heading into Iran, one place that is talked about a lot is Harg Island, which is the major center of Iran's oil industry.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Does Iran have the ability to hold that island with ground troops?
It would be difficult for everybody to do that. It would be difficult for the Americans to do an amphibious landing because Iranians have been preparing for this. There was a CNN report recently that Iranians have been laying mines and everything around the island. So that would be difficult. But Iran does not have a large ground forces unit on the island. What they might do is try to force the United States to essentially face an scorched island.
So basically burn down the oil infrastructure so that the U.S. does not have access to that oil.
Absolutely. The so-called scorched earth policy.
You sound quite bullish on Iran's capabilities right now.
What I would say is that Iranians have been preparing for this. There's no question that on a classic battlefield, the U.S. will destroy Iranian military, but that's not how Iran would like to fight the war. This is why you're seeing that they're launching missiles at the American forces in the region, on the global economy, and to try to hurt the United States where it can, and try to strike them from their weakest point.
Sina Azodi is Director of Middle East Studies at the George Washington University. You're with The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Hundreds of Palestinians gathered to protest across the West Bank today. They voiced their opposition to a new Israeli law that imposes the death penalty only on Palestinians. It would be the default sentence for Palestinians convicted of fatal attacks deemed acts of terrorism. This comes as settler violence has reached unprecedented levels in the West Bank. Jewish settlers have killed Palestinians, driven many residents from their homes, and burned down houses and cars. To learn more, we reached out to journalist Fuad Abu Ghosh in Jerusalem.
This is like really very concerning and very frightening for the prisoners, for the Palestinian prisoners who are in Israeli cells, Israeli jails. Many human rights organizations, Arabs and Israelis, rushed to appeal a petition to the Supreme Court opposing this law that was passed yesterday, which is the death penalty against terrorists, which is in this case Palestinians who attempt attacks against Israelis. This law, it could harm the reputation of Israel because it's aimed toward a special ethnic group of people. And for a democratic state like Israel, it cannot be passed because it is against a special ethnic group, the Palestinians who are living under occupation, and not also aimed toward the Israeli settlers who also living in the West Bank. So it's not going to work. It's just like simply not going to work.
Now, Israel's Minister of National Security, Itamar Ben-Gvir, head of the far-right Jewish Power Party, has been the bill's most prominent supporter. He's also a settler, which means he has an interest to push out Palestinians from the West Bank. What has been the response today in the West Bank? What are Palestinians saying about this?
They're saying basically whoever is running Israel right now, their main goal is to have maximum land and minimum people. It's, in different words, ethnic cleansing. The war between Israel and Iran, it's been like drawing attention. But meanwhile, there is a Cold War happening in the West Bank.
So since the start of the year, more than 1,500 Palestinians have been displaced due to Israeli settler attacks and access restrictions. That is 95% of the total recorded in the whole of 2025. What does displacement look like on the ground?
Okay, these people who've been displaced are living on the outskirts of area A and B, basically in an open field. They are connected to settlements and outposts where the access of the settlers is very easy to these communities, to these Palestinians.
And just for clarification, the West Bank is divided up into three areas, A, B, and C, and they have different judicial and legal definitions, correct?
Exactly, correct. Area A and B controlled fully by the Palestinian Authority. Area C is an open area, which is 62% of the West Bank that is still under Israeli control. So whenever there is a problem with Palestinians who are living in Area C, if they need any help, they need to call the Israelis or the coordination office, which is the Palestinians. By the time they will get help, it could take, you know, days. So that's why the settlers are taking advantage of this weakness point of Palestinians. So they can attack them at nights where everyone is sleeping and it's really dark. And these Palestinians fear for their lives.
Let's hear from Mohammed Harani. He's a 26-year-old Palestinian from the West Bank village of Althwani. You spoke with him yesterday, and here's how he described what everyday life is like right now.
You know, our life just turned upside down. And for example, me, I'm locked down in Masafir and I cannot go to Ramallah to continue my education due to the restriction and the daily blockade that they're imposing on every single town, village or a city. And you're just locked at your community, you know, just witnessing more and more violence and attacks. In a very small confrontation, your life will be the cost.
Your life will be the cost in a very small confrontation. What is he referring to? Is there a particular incident he's thinking of?
Yes, sure. These days, we have what's so-called the reservist units. They were armed by the national security, Itamar Gvir. So he've got the power to arm the settlers who dress with the IDF uniform, and they have weapons, and they can move freely in the West Bank, and they can basically detain and restrict movement of Palestinians. And this is the power that they've been getting. And their fingers really ease on the trigger. So any small problem, they don't hesitate to shoot to kill. Not only that, but also they are preventing the international journalists from, doing their job. They are preventing them from telling the world what's happening. And there's beyond cutting down power, water, stealing sheep and goats, you name it. Not only killing and torturing humans, but also animals. Earlier this year, they poisoned a number of sheep and they uprooted trees. So the scale of the violence that we're witnessing here is really outrageous. It's hard to imagine.
And a CNN crew was detained recently by the IDF. Everything you've been describing leads us to the financial situation for many people in the West Bank, and it's increasingly dire. I want us to hear from 59-year-old Ziad from the town of Qalqilya. He's a Palestinian in the West Bank. His brother attempted to cross the wall that seals off the West Bank from North Jerusalem. He fell and he died. Let's hear from his brother.
علما انه كان يعرف شو المخاطر المترتبه على القصه هاي الا انه
Fouad, what is he saying here?
His brother was so desperate. He was in deep debt. That's why he took the chance, and he knew what the risk and the dangers that he was facing by crossing the wall. So he paid smugglers approximately $400 to come from all the way West Bank, Qalqilya, to the Jerusalem area, where is an easy point that he can cross the wall, which is the 8 meters height wall, the separation wall between the Israeli territories and the Palestinian territories. And as a result, he skidded, he fell off on his head. The smuggler on the Israeli side was afraid to call the ambulance, so he drove him 2 hours away for help. And unfortunately, this man, he found his death on the Israeli side.
Fouad, can anyone inside or outside these communities actually investigate the recent flare-ups and violence? Is anyone being held accountable?
No. No one was held accountable because, there is no evidence. And this man, he took a chance, and the result, he skidded. But actually, the situation is getting worse right now. Since the finance minister holding over $4.4 billion revenue money for Palestinians, so the Palestinian territory and the Palestinian Authority are facing financial crisis. In the past, many Palestinians used to cross legally to Israel and earn a living and come home and have some cash in the West Bank, in the Palestinian territories. After October 7th, it's been stopped. As a result, they are desperate. They have financial crisis. They're running low on cash. Also, the Palestinian Authority also suffering from the same punishment by the finance minister, and they don't have this money. They end up having, desperate people taking high risk cross to earn a living.
Aside from the increase in violence, how is the war in Iran impacting the West Bank?
Because the eyes are at, what's happening in Iran and in Lebanon these days, the violence is increasing. We see more and more attacks by settlers, and there is no enough military personnel to prevent these settlers. And this is opportunity for settlers to carry on the violence against Palestinians.
Journalist Fouad Abu Ghosh is based in Jerusalem. More global stories coming your way. Stay with us. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The biggest electric car maker in the world, BYD, is building a new factory in Hungary. The idea is by making cars in Europe, the Chinese company can bypass EU tariffs and their thousands of inexpensive electric vehicles can stay cheap. The world has now learned that the workers building that Hungarian factory are allegedly facing brutal conditions that amount to forced labor. That's according to an upcoming report shared with our transportation correspondent Jeremy Siegel and reported here first.
When BYD's executive vice president Stella Lee took the stage at Europe's largest auto show in Munich late last year, she had big news. As she paced back and forth in front of a large screen lit up with an image of one of the company's uber-cheap electric cars, Lee told the crowd the company's first ever European construction plant in the southeastern Hungarian city of Szeged was on track to start producing cars within months.
This is the real evidence of BYD staying in Europe.
BYD has overtaken Tesla as the world's top EV manufacturer, thanks in large part to a boost in international sales. And this new facility in Hungary will be a strategic entry point in the EU market, letting the company assemble cars locally with no tariffs or import duties and gain an even stronger grip on Europe.
We're talking to hundreds of local suppliers. And our goal is to build up local ecosystem for European production.
Hungarian officials celebrated the factory's construction. In a statement, the country's foreign minister said the Szeged plant represented, quote, one of the largest investments in Hungarian economic history, one that would provide thousands of jobs to the region. But according to labor advocates, things have not turned out quite like Hungary hoped.
In September last year, we received a complaint from a Chinese worker at the BYD Szeged construction site in Hungary.
Elaine Liu with the nonprofit labor rights group China Labor Watch says many of those jobs are going to migrant workers flown in from China. And those workers are facing conditions akin to forced labor. She tells me the Chinese man who contacted them was hired to work at the BYD plant for 6 months, but that date kept getting pushed back as the plant faced construction delays. He was told if he left, his wages would be withheld, and he'd have to pay his own airfare and visa fees back to China, virtually forcing him to continue working. For Liu and her team, that was a big red flag.
And therefore, we decided to kind of understand the situation on the ground based on his complaint.
So China Labor Watch sent a secret team to the Hungarian facility to conduct interviews with workers. They spoke to 50 of them in total, and what they found went far beyond the allegations they received in that first complaint.
And so this includes things like workers having to put in excessive overtime hours of 9 to 10 hours a day. But then during the summer months, they could be working 12 to 14 hours a day. And there were continuous 7-day work weeks. Some workers were putting in 30, 31 days. So essentially working the entire month.
Liu says despite working extremely long hours with no days off, workers did not receive overtime. On top of that, 20 to 30% of their wages were withheld and deposited in a bank account in China. If they tried to go home before the plant wanted them to, they'd never see that money. China Labor Watch shared an early copy of its investigative report on the Szeged facility with the world. It's set to be released to the public next month. The report says workers were instructed to falsify reports of their hours during inspections and feared retaliation if they spoke out. They also lacked access to basic things like medical care because they were not in the country on proper work visas. As one worker described it to the organization in an interview, I can't go to the hospital for treatment. I can only rest in the dormitory to recover.
To be honest, I think a lot of the workers come to Hungary or go to other places around the world to work on these construction sites because the wages they earn is actually more than what they could potentially earn inside mainland China. And so they're, I guess, enticed by this. But when they do come, the conditions are difficult.
To further complicate things, the workers China Labor Watch spoke with weren't hired by BYD itself, but by contractors and subcontractors, making it difficult to even lodge a formal complaint about conditions.
Whether intentional or not, it does obfuscate who has responsibility in the employment relationship.
That's Eli Friedman, a professor of global labor and work at Cornell, who specializes in Chinese labor practices.
The major problem that we have that was revealed in this case in Hungary is that you have these multi-tier layers of subcontractors. So you have the person or the company that's responsible for the project. And then there's going to be two, sometimes three layers of subcontractors between the workers and the company that's responsible for the project.
In the case of the BYD factory, it appears to be a hodgepodge of different employers. Some of the 4,000 construction workers there were hired by BYD directly, others by subcontractors. China Labor Watch says the subcontractors regularly impose so-called recruitment fees of up to nearly $3,000 for being offered a job that had to be paid back before workers could leave. The organization calls this practice debt bondage and says laborers are forced to stay at work despite brutal conditions. I contacted BYD for comment multiple times, but heard nothing back. I eventually tracked down the phone number of one of those subcontractors used on the project, a Hungarian company called AIM Construction, which is a subsidiary of a construction company in China.
Hello.
A man picks up the phone. I explain to him that I'm a reporter working on a story about labor conditions at the BYD plant in Szeged.
Sorry, I'm not so suitable for talking. Sorry. Can you call me later? Okay.
I tell him, sure, and ask when I can call back. He doesn't answer and just says,
thank you. Have a nice day. Bye.
I tried calling back several times to no response. I also emailed the company repeatedly, but heard nothing back. China Labor Watch did send its findings to Hungarian officials in a letter late last year. The regional labor inspector is now conducting an investigation, but a spokesperson told me they cannot provide further information because the probe is ongoing. Meantime, BYD is set to start producing thousands of cars at the plant this spring. For The World, I'm Jeremy Siegel.
Jeremy joins me in the studio to discuss his reporting more. Hey, Jeremy.
Hey, Carolyn.
So, as you mentioned, BYD, the world's top-selling electric vehicle maker. What could this investigation mean for them?
It's not really clear what sort of punishment, if any, BYD could face as a result of all of this. You know, as I said in my story, the local authorities in Hungary are investigating China Labor Watch's findings. The group also sent their allegations to a number of larger European governing bodies, including the European Commission and the European Parliament. None of them returned my request for comment, but I think if these allegations of forced labor are confirmed, it could pose a big PR problem for BYD because this is not an isolated incident at the end of the day. BYD also has a factory in Brazil where investigators recently found similar problems that they say amounted to slavery-like conditions. The Washington Post actually had a big story on this recently. When you put these findings alongside the image of BYD as trying to cultivate for itself globally as this affordable option, you know, to make the switch to an electric car, a company that's helping facilitate a green revolution for other countries, it's problematic. And because at the end of the day, business, especially internationally, is booming for BYD, they don't want anything like this to change that.
And I wonder if this is particularly bad timing for bad PR for BYD, because, you know, I imagine some people are looking more toward EVs right now as gas prices are skyrocketing.
They are. Even before the war, BYD was experiencing a surge. And then the war in Iran put them even further out as the number one seller of electric cars. It really thrust them into a sort of spotlight because with the conflict in the Middle East, there have been spikes in oil prices, electric cars and battery power more generally. They're seeing a big boost in interest, and they are with their stocks too. BYD specifically, their shares are on track for their best month in over a year because of all this. And Bloomberg recently reported that the company is now expecting to beat its export targets for 2026. And projects like the Hungary car plant I reported on, they're a big driver of that growth. But I think it's clear that that growth has immense human consequences.
We have heard for a long time about poor working conditions and even forced labor in Chinese factories in China. Is this a sign that that is being exported?
Yes. All of the experts I spoke with told me we're likely to see more of this in the years ahead. You know, as you mentioned, we've known about many of these issues within China. Eli Friedman, the professor who studies China labor practices you heard from before, he told me this practice of big companies like BYD using a series of confusing contractors and subcontractors for construction projects, it's really commonplace on the mainland, and new Chinese business initiatives are likely to make them common elsewhere. Under the country's current leader, Xi Jinping, Chinese companies are being encouraged to expand their international investments, to export not just their products, but actually the production of these products. And that's in part because they want to keep growing beyond just demand inside of China. It looks like international demand is there. I actually recently spoke to one expert on Chinese tech who said, we've reached this sort of of inflection point where, like, the Made in China labels that you'll see, they're shifting from something that would indicate an inferior product now to something that's super desirable for consumers around the globe. You know, BYD, that's a shining example of that. But as these companies export their businesses abroad, they're also exporting their business practices. And advocates say these labor violations that were found in BYD's factory in Hungary and also in Brazil, they're likely just the tip of the iceberg.
The world's transportation correspondent, Jeremy Siegel, thank you very much for your reporting.
Thanks, Carolyn.
For those of you following college basketball's March Madness, you no doubt caught Sunday's thriller.
Mullins tosses it up. Oh! It's good! With 0.3, UConn goes in front!
The University of Connecticut's incredible buzzer-beater upset over number one ranked Duke. It's hardly the final whistle, though, for one particular player at Duke, 19-year-old freshman guard Dame Sarr. Sarr's parents are from Senegal, and he grew up in Italy watching NCAA college hoops on his cell phone. Sarr himself showed incredible promise early on, turning pro in Europe at the age of 16. The World's Jerry Haddon reports from Barcelona on Dame Sarr's curious journey from the pros to college.
Sarr, it would seem, is a sort of Benjamin Button of basketball, dribbling backwards from the big leagues to something smaller.
Sarr se levanta, Sarr solo.
Exactly 1 year ago, the Duke freshman was playing pro ball for FC Barcelona, one of the world's top basketball teams outside the NBA. In this game, the 6'8" guard showed his promise as Barca spanked Spanish league rival Rio Breogán 102-79.
Animal! Salvaje!
Sarr's an animal, shouted one TV commentator, a wild animal, as the teenager came off the bench to dunk, defend, and strike again and again from three-point territory. Sarr racked up 21 points that day. Lifelong Barca fan Mark Guadi remembers.
Lo que recuerdo era que era muy eléctrico. O sea, era un dos que un poco, a mí me recordaba un poco a Corey Higgins.
Sarr was just electric, he says, while waiting outside Barca's stadium before a recent game. He reminded me of Corey Higgins, he says, the way he could drive to the hoop but also hit from the floor and play great defense. Higgins was an American player who went from college to the pros, first in Russia, then as a star here with Barca before retiring a couple of years ago. Sarr seemed set on a similar path, but then he walked away. First, just for a couple of days.
Nightfall in the Pacific Northwest. It is the home to the Nike Hoop Summit.
Last spring, Sarr went to Portland, Oregon to this yearly All-Star game pitting the top U.S. high school players against the best Europeans. Barca had initially given Sarr permission to go, but then the club backtracked, said it needed him for a big match against arch-rival Madrid. Sarr defied the club and went to Portland anyway. Barca was not happy. Sarr got asked about it while there. I think it's really sad that my club is upset, he told a reporter, because I'm part of the team. I always support Barca, he said, and I'm supporting them from here. Morally, he must have meant. Back home, Barca lost that game to Madrid. Many Barca fans, like Mark Guadi, never forgave him. If there's a big game that you need to play in, your fans count on you, Guadi says. Sarr, he says, is on my blacklist for eternity. He's a traitor. Team Barca was much more diplomatic about it, at least in public, even as the club and Sarr parted ways over the dispute. But Sarr also got something from the summit, an invitation to play and study at Duke. Playing in the NCAA, says reporter Marc Mundet, is what Sarr wanted all along. Mundet's been covering European hoops from Barcelona for nearly three decades. He now runs his own basketball news agency called Basket Lab. He says stepping down from the pros to become a college player in the U.S. is, in many ways, a step up.
Porque desde hace cierto tiempo, con los nil contracts que ofrece la NCAA.
Why? Because the NCAA now offers students the chance to earn a lot more money, he says, compared to typical European pro salaries. The average new signee with Barca, for example, he says, earns around $200,000 a year. And Barca's top tier, lower ranked teams pay much less, he says. By contrast, top NCAA stars can earn well over $1 million a year. Universities don't pay them directly, but in 2021, the NCAA allowed for so-called NIL contracts. NIL stands for Name, Image, and Likeness. It lets players earn money indirectly through endorsements. Sarr's exact earnings aren't public, but he's been a standout at Duke his first year, especially on defense. He was asked about it by a Duke reporter after one game this season.
My superpower, you know, so I feel like...
Defense is my superpower, he said, amidst the din of a crowded locker room. I'm defending and just trying to bring energy to the team, he said. I owe it that. Duke's done for the year, but Sarr himself has been tipped as a likely first-round NBA draft pick in May. And everyone, including basketball fans and players in Europe, knows that that's where the real money is, which might explain why some Barca supporters are more forgiving of Sarr than the fan who says Sarr's on his eternal blacklist. Before a Barca home game last week, fans lined up to enter the Barcelona stadium. One fan who didn't want to give his name says he holds no grudge against Sarr for leaving. He has every right to try to earn as much as possible, he says. I just hope he comes back one day, because here, he says, the quality of life is better. That will likely take time, says reporter Mark Mundet. For now, he says, there's a growing exodus of young athletes. Call it a brawn drain. Teens like Sarr drawn by the dollars and the chance to study abroad.
Ahora mismo, por ejemplo, hay tres jugadores que lo están haciendo muy bien.
We have three young standouts at the moment who've left Spain for the States, he says, and they're doing great. And clubs here, says Mundet, are opting to play the long game, maintaining their relationships with the very players who've abandoned them.
Él estaba en Zaragoza, jugando en primera división.
Only between 1 and 2% of college players in the U.S. make it to the NBA, Mundet says. As for the rest, they're going to come home. Even players who do get drafted still usually return, if not years later. Older, sure, but more experienced, like Ricky Rubio and Pau Gasol, two Spanish NBA standouts who came back for at least one final year of fine play in the league where they first cut their teeth. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Barcelona.
You're with The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Passover begins tomorrow at sundown with a ceremonial feast, the Seder. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that for most Jews, the Seder is the only time when gefilte fish makes an appearance on the table, but not for Kat Romano of Montreal. She's a Jewish food historian who puts on lots of events highlighting the Canadian city's diverse Jewish cuisine. She works under a pseudonym, The Wandering Chew, C-H-E-W. We'll get to her gefilte fish tricks in a moment, but our conversation began with an explanation for why Jews eat matzah during this annual reenactment of the escape from slavery.
There wasn't time for Jews to let their bread rise, so they brought thin bread that hadn't risen.
Right, unleavened bread. Parts of the Passover table will be consistent from family to family and across geographic regions, but Jewish food doesn't really trace back to any one specific place. And Montreal's Jewish community, you've got these iconic Jewish eateries, two famous bagel shops. There's Schwartz's Deli, of course, and its smoked meat. It also has a Jewish food scene that's more experimental. What's going on there?
Of course, yeah. There's so much amazing stuff happening in Montreal. So like you said, we have the super iconic traditional Jewish restaurants and bakeries that have really shaped not only Jewish food in Montreal, but I think the larger food culture in the city. Those remain beloved. But we also have a new generation of chefs and cooks who are opening new restaurants and really bringing Jewish food culture of Montreal in new directions.
Are you seeing some of these cultural twists migrating to the Seder table at Passover?
I do see people, even maybe if it's not at the Seder, where sometimes tradition rules, I do see it coming into the holiday. So people are bringing in flavors from other communities. You can find flavors like preserved lemon and ras el hanout and date syrup and rose petals coming into the holiday.
And ras el hanout, that's really kind of a North African spice mixture, correct?
That's right. And I used to run a restaurant and I made gravlax with it. So I would let the, along with the salt and the sugar, I added Ras Al Hanout to the curing mix, and it created this beautiful, like, warm, fragrant gravlax that I paired with preserved lemon cream cheese. You could even do that on your matzah.
What does all this diversity tell us about the Jewish population in Montreal?
In the late 50s and early 60s, we had a large immigration of Jews from North Africa, specifically Morocco. Because of the French language, they spoke French in Morocco. And so coming to Montreal made it an easier transition. And so their food has really become part of the food culture, to the extent that on our Shabbat tables, even if you're not in a Moroccan Jewish household, you'll often find a dish called salad krit, also known as makbucha, a slow-cooked dip that's made of tomatoes, roasted peppers, garlic, paprika, salt, olive oil, and you cook it down till it gets really jammy. That really originated in Morocco.
Have you ever experimented with a crucial component of the Seder table in a way that got you really excited?
Yes. One way I love to, you know, bring new things to my Seder is through charoset. So charoset is a fruit and nut mixture that's meant to represent the mortar that the Israelites used to build the pyramids while they were slaves in Egypt. And it's a ritual food that you will find at every Seder, but it will differ depending on the background of the family. The most well-known charoset, I think, especially in Montreal, in North America, is one that's made with apples and walnuts and cinnamon and a sweet wine like Menashevitz. But in other places, they are very different. And so I really like to look at traditional charosets from around the world and make those for my Seder. So one of my favorites that I've found is from the Jewish community of Curaçao, which is one of the oldest Jewish communities in the Americas. And they are tropical charoset truffles, and they're made with dates, prunes, raisin, figs, orange zest, and lime juice. And they're rolled in toasted coconut. They're honestly so delicious. Oh, and of course, there's peanuts, which really adds to the flavor.
Are peanuts allowed, though? Because aren't they a legume?
Yes. So for some Ashkenazi Jews who might not eat these, you can sub in almonds or walnuts. Our Sephardic Jews will eat legumes during Passover.
Yeah. A few years ago, I tried making an Iraqi haroseth with pistachios, dates, and pomegranate syrup and pomegranate seeds. That was pretty good.
That sounds wonderful.
We got to get to that gefilte fish. got to have the horseradish. Have you found a way to make it for people who just come to it with all kinds of prejudice?
Yes. I just force it on them. again, at the restaurant I used to run, I made a gefilte fish club sandwich. And, you know, many people would turn their nose up at it, but the key to it was the homemade gefilte fish that I made. And it's still the recipe I make at home. It's not, you know, like those balls you buy at the store in a jar. What I usually do is grind up some white fish. It can be cod or tilapia, or caramelized onions that I mix with that white fish. I put in lemon zest and fresh dill, salt, pepper, and some lemon juice. Bake it in a pan that has water in it. And what that does is it allows the gefilte fish not to dry out, and it remains really soft and tender.
On the Wandering Chew website, you have instructions for making your own matzo. For most of us, matzo comes out of a box, right? So briefly, yes. How do you do it?
Yes. So I like to make my own matzo because, one, it's so easy to make. It's, you know, literally just flour and water that you cook at a really high heat quite quickly. But the other thing is, I think it harks back to a time before when everything for Passover was made at home. And so you're linking yourself back to this long tradition.
Well, I'm really glad to hear about the waiver on peanuts, because maybe you can adapt this down there. My favorite Passover dessert that I've invented is the fluffernutza. It's matzah, salted. It's got to be salted. Fluff and peanut butter.
Oh, my goodness.
And talk about mortar. I strongly recommend a glass of milk for that.
I am definitely going to try that this year.
That was Kat Romano of the Wandering Chew in Montreal.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org and check out more of our original reporting on YouTube. We are at The World News GBH. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Judy Pigott, the Gruber Family Foundation, the Schmidt Family Foundation, and Gavin Salmanese, LLC. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.